Hi, y'all. I'm so glad to see this room packed. I think so often we are so focused on our small campaigns and so focused on doing all these actions that we don't really get to think about economics and what we actually want to do after capitalism. Because that day might just come, and we need to be prepared. I had the privilege of having Hanel as my professor last semester, and really did gain a lot from his wealth of knowledge, so I hope you all, I know an hour and a half is a short amount of time, but here goes.
I thought I was just facilitating a workshop, and I'm straight off the highway from southern Pennsylvania. Sorry, I'm a little bit late and did not catch other things that have gone on yesterday and today. What I thought this workshop wanted to discuss was what I call living what it is that we believe in. And it's not something that is discussed very often. There's a lot of reasons for that. One is we have a lot of discussion that we go through amongst ourselves and with people outside our movement about what's wrong in the terrible society that surrounds us. So we spend most of our time on that. But that wasn't going to be what we talked about today in this workshop. Then we spend much less time on something that I have spent 20 years thinking more about than anything else, which is, what would we really replace this awful capitalist economy with? I probably, much as you, was influenced as a student in the 60s, first by discovering how horrific our capitalist economy really was, and then discovering that people had written about alternatives long before I was born. We had a number of examples of visionary, libertarian, anarcho-syndicalist, commo-syndicalist, whatever. Writings about basically suggesting the following, you know, it isn't that difficult to do far better than capitalism. It's doable, and we can do it, and we should never allow ourselves to be convinced that we cannot somehow organize our economic activities and our economic lives in a way that is more sensible, that is more efficient. In that day and age, 25 years ago, most of us didn't think about in ways that preserve rather than destroy the environment. And certainly more equitable and just and more democratic, that those are possible things that can be done. Now, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that and writing about that, but that also wasn't really to be the purpose of this workshop as I understood it. For those of us who are convinced that there is a desirable alternative to capitalism and that it is something that we can loosely think of as the economics of equitable cooperation rather than the economics of competition and greed, how are we going to go about struggling for that? And I have long believed that a very important component of struggling for that is working out ways to live according to those values and ideals for a whole host of important reasons. One is, people who were disgusted by capitalism over 100 years ago came and preached that capitalism was not only awful, but there was a far better alternative. But then, to a great extent, what replaced capitalism, and in the popular consciousness, what became the alternative to capitalism, which was called, and we can discuss till we're blue in the face, whether it was mislabeled socialism, it never resembled socialism. I've written and read about that for 25 years too. But it was not a desirable alternative to capitalism. People remember that. People know that just because somebody comes along and points out to you what's wrong with capitalism, and just because they say there's a far better way to organize the economy, doesn't mean they really know what they're doing. And doesn't mean that it would turn out better. Maybe it would turn out better in some ways, but it might turn out far worse in other ways. Well, one reason to start to live the alternative that we believe in is to begin to demonstrate to people outside our movement who have every reason to be skeptical that in fact it's possible and that it's desirable. There are other reasons to work this out. And that is that we can sit down and discuss the alternatives, but we will not get it right. We will have things wrong. And we need to be practicing the things we think work to discover to what extent they don't. And that we have to make some changes and adjustments. And we have to understand some things that we didn't understand very clearly, although we thought we did. And we knew we were right, that we could do far better than capitalism. We're not going to discover we're wrong about that. But we're going to discover, in all probability, as we begin living a different way of organizing our economic lives, that we were deceiving ourselves in some ways or others about what was easy, what was a problem, what was not a problem. And the other major reason that I think it's of critical importance to think about this and to begin to do this is I do believe that one of the great difficulties in sustaining a movement is providing ways for people who enter the movement, such as yourself, and become committed and convinced to making the world a better place. We somehow have to start to build lives that don't last for 5 years, for 6 years, that don't work only for single people or people who are childless, who work for people of all ages, and that one can live one's entire life and be sustained in a life of activism. We need to build the kinds of communities that basically practice our values, develop the ways in which we need to go about these things. And we need those communities because those are the kinds of, we need those communities to sustain ourselves. Now, during the April demonstrations, I had sort of a surprise visit from a group that came from Winnipeg, Canada. And they had been 36 hours straight on a bus. And they had called, one person had called me and said, well, there's a few of us that are coming in for the demonstrations, and we live up here in Winnipeg, and we are part of a Mondragon collective where we have a few businesses and we have some living arrangements where we know about your book called Participatory Economics, and we thought those values made a lot of sense, and we've been busy trying to sort of make this work. And we just thought we'd drop in and talk to you if you're going to be there and you're going to be at the demonstrations anyway. To my great surprise, I was also about 5 minutes late getting there. It was like 2:00 in the afternoon on the Wednesday. And there was going to be a good demonstration down at the Mexican embassy that the Zapatista support people were organizing. And I had to do something with that. And when I came over to my office, some of my fellow faculty members saw me as I was walking in, and they said, who are those people? I said, what people? There's a whole hall full of people out there that said they're waiting to see you. And there were about 36 people who had gotten off this bus, and they also said, well, makes sense. We should go down and we'll go down to the Mexican embassy. This is the Wednesday of that April week. But it would be nice to talk for a little bit. It was a nice day. We sat outside. And the question, I was incredibly impressed because the question they posed immediately was, what went wrong for you people? How did you manage to fail to continue to live in a way that allowed you to do the things you believe in? Because we don't want that to happen to us. And we can see, we can begin to see the dangers of how those things do happen. Well, we talked about it for a couple of hours. I was impressed because I thought, you know, I'm glad they know enough to know that they don't need to talk about the economics of globalization with me. They already know enough about what's wrong about it. They already know that something better than capitalism is possible. They're thinking about the really critical problem for them. And it's a critical problem not just for them and for us. It's a critical problem for the future of the world, because if we can't figure out the answer to that, then it is very difficult to broaden and deepen the kind of movement that will have to be big enough, powerful enough, and long-lasting enough to actually change things. So I was impressed that they posed that question. We talked about it for a couple of hours. Nobody has magical answers. And basically, I think that that's the question that we should have a workshop about today. Let me simply pose some of the problems that arise. Kids, I have five. We also live in a total, and this wasn't true for the Canadians from Winnipeg. They were a little amazed to hear that we had even a more serious problem in this area than they do in Canada. All civilized societies basically at least finance their education system. So it's a public education system. But of course we don't do that here in the United States. And one inevitably poses the dilemma of, you want to do the best for your kids. You want them to have the opportunities that they can make good use of. And the way we finance higher education in the United States, that can become a very expensive proposition. Now, if we live in egalitarian sort of sustainable communities, if we figure out some way so that we can essentially receive reward for economic needs in accordance with the work or the effort we do, and we work out some way of arranging that with a broader group of people than our own little nuclear family, how are we going to deal with that issue? How do we deal with the fact that people from within our community are going to have legitimate needs to resources outside our community that somehow will have to make decisions about how they're provided, if they are provided, on what sort of base, etc.? What do we do about the fact that what we believe, how we think people should be rewarded for work, is not how the outside economy rewards people for work? How do we deal with the question, how are we going to deal with the problem when it arises, which it will inevitably arise, and it'll arise over and over and over again, that somebody from within our movement can go out and get a job in a dot-com? My eldest son just did that this year. He was in graduate school, wasn't happy with his program, dropped out, had himself a nice math degree, and a dot-com came along and offered to pay him a ridiculous salary, way beyond anything he did. Way beyond anything he had any right to sort of deserve or want. Which he knows. He said, well, I guess I'm going to do this because I do have $40,000 worth of student loans and I can pay it off in 1 year. So what do I say to him? I said, go for it! Another major dilemma that we will face as we try to live the kind of lives we believe in and we wish all to be able to choose to live if they should so choose and want, is how to go about that in a way that doesn't isolate ourselves from the people that we need to reach out to. That's a very difficult thing. I didn't think I was making a speech, and I didn't come with handouts, and I certainly don't have enough for everybody. But there's about 30 copies of a one-page thing here, and one of the things that's listed on there, one of the ideas was, I was going to say, well, there are some resources that you can go look at. There are people who have been trying to organize and live in what one group calls egalitarian sustainable communities. Some of these communities go back 25, 30 years. There also are some environmentally oriented sustainable communities. There's a whole network of them up in the northeastern part of the United States. And you can go to various places on the internet and sort of find out about these people. But how in general do those of us who do that kind of thing, who go ahead and become parts of communities like that, whether it's an environmental community, one of the interesting new developments in this sustainable egalitarian community network of sort of groups is that the early ones basically became farming type activities. And in that particular network, in the past 5 or 6 years, urban groups, the one that I met and talked with was one called Beacon Hill House that's out in the Seattle area. These are urban groups where people get together, they live, they pool resources in some sense or another. Some of them have sort of straight jobs with decent incomes. Others are working full-time for movement organizations that either don't pay or pay very little. Of course, we want to be able to work. We don't want to always have to go in order to make a living, sustain a family, contribute to kids that we feel responsible for. We don't want to be in the position where we're always tempted by that sort of mainstream enviro group that would actually pay you. No, we want to be able to work for the organizations we believe in. Well, one way to do that is you've got people living together and there's some outside jobs that are basically funding, paying salaries or paying wages and living expenses for people who are doing other things. I know lots of you do this. I know that's the way that movement activists work and have always worked. But it's important to work. It's important to improve how well we do that, and to improve it with an eye to how it can become long-term and how it can become sustaining, and at the same time not isolating. So this Beacon Hill House, for instance, and some of the newer groups that have become part of this egalitarian, sustainable living communities network. Are basically in cities. Sometimes they rent a building. Sometimes they go ahead and buy a building. It's people working in urban jobs. And then basically what they view, to some extent, they figure out ways where that money and any time that people have is something they discuss about, well, are we going to... They were talking about what contributions to make, financial contributions they were going to be making to various groups and political activities in the Seattle area. And then what contributions that their group makes in terms of time, in terms of the amount of time that they have people who are putting into to activities. I think really what I have to say on this subject is I'm convinced it's a far more important issue than most people in the movement have ever believed it is. When we discuss this, when the movement discusses this, it usually gets discussed as burnout, which is sort of a real badass way of coming at it. Burnout is the consequence of having failed to succeed in helping people live the way we believe and we preach is possible. We don't need solutions. We don't need to find a solution to burnout after burnout has taken place. Instead, we need to be more constantly thinking about how it is that we nurture and care for ourselves and others in ways that are consistent with our values, that are fair, that are democratic, and that are not confined to a subculture or a part of the age distribution, and that do not tend to isolate us and make it more difficult for people. We want something that people of all ages and all racial communities and cultural backgrounds can look at and say, those people are out there practicing what they preach. And they say, what they preach sounds pretty damn good. But I want to know what it looks like. I want to know whether it looks like they're enjoying themselves. Whether it really is a better way of life. Because that's what they claim. And that's what I want to know before I join up. And before I get involved. And I just think that that's a problem that gets far too little attention. We too seldom discuss the serious obstacles and problems that have to be overcome. And I know, as a participant in the anti-globalization movement, that we're in it for the long haul. This isn't going to go away. We can't gear ourselves up to go engage in nonviolent civil disobedience twice a year for 5 or 6 years and think that's going to do it, because it's not. So in any case, I knew I wasn't going to come with solutions. Even if I'd been told, you're going to give a talk to a group this big, I wasn't going to come up with solutions. And I would like to try and run this at this point as a workshop and have people speak to this question and voice concerns or ideas or put issues or questions to others too.